Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Elodie Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And my co-host, Alfred Addisk, will be joining James Corbett of The Corbett Report right here, right after the first segment of today's program. But there's going to be a little bit of a change today. I do want to give the date today. It's Thursday, April 27th, 2017. So I am live right now, but all of you know I'm having problems with my allergies. I'm on the phone all day long. I talk all day long. And about this time of the day, it's just been difficult. So I wasn't even sure I could do the complete 20 minutes. So after the market report today, you will be hearing Alfred prior to his you'll hear Alfred's opening prior to his interview with James Corbett. So, you know, when I stop speaking after the market report, you will hear Al. And and I want to thank you for your patience while I get through this. There's so much to talk about. Durable goods, orders for durable goods came out today, and that was a lot less. We'll bring that to you tomorrow. There's a lot of interesting information going on out there. There was a great Reuters report about Israel striking an arms supply hub operated by Hezbollah in Syria. So, and they've done this before in January. So it just adds a little bit more interest to everything that's going on. But for now, I will give the market report, and then you will hear Alfred's voice when I stop speaking after the report. So again, thank you for your patience. Make sure you tune in tomorrow. We will both be here, Alfred and myself. And for all your gold and silver coin needs, make sure you give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And of course, visit our website at dgscoins.com. And let's get to the market report. We have gold down $5.40. It was up earlier in the day, $12.64.60. Silver was down 22 cents at $17.36. Platinum is down 6 at $948. Palladium was up 5 at $819. The USDX today was stronger, 0.10 at 99.07. Crude oil was down 0.42 at 49.20. Paper markets today, you have the Dow up a whole 6 points, 20,981. You have the NASDAQ up 23 at 6,048.94. Not 6,400, but 6,048. The S&P was up 1 at 2,388. You have the euro trading at 109. That was down 0.27. 10-year yield still holding at 2.30%. And again, James Corbett will be here after the first, during the second break, and or after the first break, I should say. And that tells me I am gone. You will now hear Alfred's voice, and we'll be here tomorrow. Thank you.
Democratic leaders have said that it would not get it. That support would not be forthcoming if funds for the wall were included. That is interesting to me because it seems to me that the Democrats' natural constituency, blacks, poor, women, illegal aliens, are far more dependent on government operations than are your average Trump supporters and Republicans. In other words, if government shuts down, it's likely to hit the Democratic constituency more than it is the Republican constituency. And so we're left to wonder, can the Democrat Party cause a government shutdown and not be identified as the primary culprits and blamed for the shutdown? I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think the Democrats can do this. I don't think they can stop. I don't think they can cause the shutdown and avoid responsibility for having done so. And this is over the issue of whether we're going to allow illegal aliens to come into this country or not. It's not just the wall. It's whether we are going to allow illegal aliens to come into this country. And if they do, whose jobs are they going to take? They're going to take the jobs that have been primarily held by the Democratic constituency. Sooner or later, you'd have to suppose that the Democrats are going to look at this. The members, you know, the rank and file are going to say, you know, the party is actually trying to do us in. The wall would be good for average Democrats. or at least it would seem to be so. It would protect their jobs. And you would think that was an important consideration, but the Democrat leadership apparently disagrees. They apparently think they will stop the wall no matter what so they can bring more illegal aliens into this country because they believe the illegal aliens will support the Democrat Party and make the Democrat Party the majority in this country. And they don't care, even if it's a Mexican majority, they don't care. There's a problem here with the Democratic Party. Can the Democrat Party cause a government shutdown without doing massive harm to their own constituents? Can they do that harm to their own constituents without losing some of their political base? Won't some Americans who are currently, they believe themselves to be Democrats, they identify with the Democrat Party, and they say, listen, if you're going to shut down the government and shut down my access and by in order to allow illegal aliens to come into this country that may take my job, or at least hold my wages down. You know? There are a lot of those people are going to walk away from the Democratic Party, and it leads me to wonder if the Democratic Party has a death wish, because they have behaved in a way that's irrational, brutish, thuggish, since the November election, and I'm not sure that they're ready to stop doing that yet. There's another article on the same subject from the Economic Collapse blog by Michael Snyder. And the headline is, Democrats, Trump must surrender on funding a border wall to avoid a government shutdown on his 100th day in office. And that article, lengthy, but I just got a couple of paragraphs from it. It says, is Donald Trump going to unconditionally surrender to the Democrats and completely give up his dream of building a border wall in order to avoid a government shutdown on his 100th day in office? As I've warned before, the Democrats are perfectly willing to force a government shutdown if the Trump administration and the Republicans in Congress do not let them win all of the key battles in this funding bill fight. It's being reported that the Trump administration wants $3 billion for extra border security and for construction of a border wall. And the Democrats are insisting that they will keep any bill that includes money for a border wall from ever getting through Congress. And of course, the Democrats are also taking a very hard line on funding Planned Parenthood, federal support for key Obamacare provisions, and resistance to increased defense spending. If the Trump administration and enough establishment Republicans in Congress cave in to the outrageous demands of the Democrats, a government shutdown will be avoided. If they cave in, if the Republicans cave in to the Democrats, right? The Republicans are the majority. They won the election. In theory, they won it because the majority of the American people want to go in a particular direction, and the Democrats are saying, essentially, screw that. We're going to have what we want and act with the rest of you. So, If the Republicans do not cave in, a government shutdown will begin April 29th. That would be this Saturday, and could easily turn out to be the longest government shutdown in the history of the United States. If Trump gives up on his border wall now, it is quite likely that he will never get it. So the question remains, here we are, we have two more days before we find out for sure. Are the Democrats going to allow the construction of the border wall? And if they do, it seems to me that they will back away from a certain amount of thuggery that they've been involved in the last, that's been apparent since they lost the election in November. They would behave in a way that might be considered civilized, or are they going to emulate Kim Jong-un from Korea, North Korea, who doesn't know when to shut up? And the Democrats apparently don't know when to shut up. And I can't help but wonder, are they destroying their own party? What is happening to the Democrats? I mean, there is chaos. Are they, and will they attract more thugs? You know, they have subsidized, at least with sympathy and perhaps with currency, the disruption of events that supported Trump, or attempts to disrupt those events, with professional thugs. They've subsidized them to attack the Trump, the people who support Trump, has been in the news. What is this? This is dangerous. We've got a party that is behaving like a bunch of communists who insist on taking over from the Tsar in Russia, or at least from the Bolsheviks, and taking over with violence. And not everything, certainly not everything, not a majority. This is a minority influence in their Democrat Party, or at least that's the way it seems to be so far. But insofar as it's being tolerated, they are sowing the whirlwind, in my opinion. Because if you're going to let a bunch of thugs into your party and invite them to go crack some skulls from their who are Republicans and or Trump supporters, eventually those same thugs are going to find a home in the Democratic Party. And eventually they will also attack Democrat officials who get in their way. Which is why I think the Democrats may be sowing the whirlwind, and if they do, they're going to reap the whirlwind. You want to bring thugs into your party? You want to bring gangsters and people who try to win their way with violence rather than civil discourse and argument and political activity? Just go out and break some skulls? Is that what you want? I mean, I don't think you can do that without turning your party into something that will become embarrassing, shameful, anathema for virtually everyone. Party members, members of the Democratic Party, and people of the United States all throughout. By fostering and subsidizing street thugs, the Democrats are working to destroy their own party, or at least turn it into an overtly criminal communist nest of gangsters. And it leaves a lot of us wondering. You know, you sit back and you're faced with the question. There's a lot of people who have identified as Democrats for much of their lives. All right? That's not me. I'm not one of them. I voted for one Democrat in all my life. It was one judge I knew about that I thought was okay, but other than that, I voted Republican or Libertarian. I'm not a fan of the Democratic Party. But this is beyond anything I've seen in the past, or at least that's the way it appears to me. And I have to wonder how many people can look at the problems that the Democrat Party is facing and say, boy, I sure want to be a Democrat. I want to grow up to be a Democrat. I want to join the Democrat Party. I think the only people that are really interested in the Democratic Party right now and saying, you know, I'm thinking about joining the Democratic Party. And maybe we could start, you know, maybe the Bloods and the Crips, illegal aliens. What is that Central American gang? What is it, MS-13 or something like that? I don't remember the name of it. But the Democrats are doing themselves great harm right now. And it may be that they've been doing themselves great harm for quite a while insofar as they've allowed Hillary Clinton to be their standard bearer. I mean, the simple truth is, yeah, she was in the White House as the First Lady for a while. Yes, she meddled in a few things, and she threw her weight around and a bunch of things. She became Secretary of State. She was a senator from New York for a while. But she was a thug herself. I mean, there are more than enough reports to raise suspicion that Hillary is not just amoral, but immoral. Prone to violence, hysteria, screaming to get her own way. What was wrong with the Democratic Party? I mean, that they would promote her for their standard bearer. It's evidence of a kind of a predisposition to violence that's been perhaps growing in the Democrat Party ever since Bill Clinton was elected. I don't mean that Bill appeared to be particularly violent, but on the other hand, Congressman Dannemeyer, back when, in the first year or so of Clinton administration, he pointed out that Bill Clinton, I believe at the time it was 23 or 26 people who had been close to Clinton, had died under mysterious or violent circumstances. And by the time, last time I heard, other people continued keeping track of the list of Clinton cronies who died under strange circumstances. And I think last I heard it was something like 46. I don't know 46 people who've died in my entire life. And especially if you take out my folks, I'm 72, so my folks are gone and my grandparents are gone and, you know, uncles and aunts and one thing another like that. That's just a natural part of life. You eliminate them from the list of people I've known who've passed on, and they didn't pass on in violent or dangerous or mysterious circumstances. I don't know, one guy I knew who died in Vietnam, woman I knew just died in September. Much to my surprise, I didn't hear about it until just in the last this last week. But Bill Clinton has allegedly 46 people. That can't be that he's known, that have been closely associated with him, that have died under violent or mysterious circumstances, and that is strange. Like Vince Foster, the guy that worked with the Clintons at the Rose Law Firm in Arkansas and later traveled with the Clintons, worked in the White House with Bill and Hillary. He died under strange circumstances, found his body in the park, no mud on his shoes. He got in somehow without walking on the ground, apparently. Right? And there were other peculiarities, and they claimed it was a suicide. But one of the things that set me off on that right from the beginning, the first day after Vince Foster was found dead, Bill Clinton appeared, and he said in one of his speeches, he was just talking to the media, essentially, and he said, you know, we may never know who killed Vince Foster. Really? You know, if I were the President of the United States, and I had access to the CIA and the National Security Agency and the federal and the FBI, and I have no idea how many other investigative agencies he has control over, and someone murdered someone who worked in the White House, who was one of my close friends, or allegedly one of my close friends, and somebody killed him, I would not concede in the first 24 hours that, gee, we may never know who killed Vince Foster. I guarantee you I'd make it my business, because whoever got him might be coming after me too. Might be coming after my wife or my kids. He's somebody close by. Who got to my buddy Bill? Who got to my buddy Vince, excuse me? And I would have found out, but Clinton, he was willing to say, well, gee, it's a mystery, and we're going to write it off. He was ready to write it off within 24 hours of Vince Foster's death. And I thought from the moment I saw that, there's something funny here. Which, all of which implied that Clinton knew very well who was responsible for Vince Foster's death. And all of which implies that this is another illustration of violence that's associated with Hillary Clinton. And you have to wonder what, and Bill Clinton, of course, and you have to wonder, what has the Democratic Party been doing for the last, 20 years? How long has this been going on? Is this something that can be, that is tolerable, manageable, or is it self-destructive and evidence of a kind of political suicide? Well, we won't find out for a couple more years. We'll watch and see now what happens with the shutdown. Will the Democrats make the shutdown happen? And if they do, will it actually help them, or will it diminish the power of their party? We're going to take a break for a couple of commercials. When we return, James Corbett should be joining us from Japan. Please stay tuned.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csetalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from the Corbett Report. All right, some of the best comments, commentary, observation, insight on geopolitics and economics that you can find on the Internet, the Corbett Report. Hello, James.
Hi, good to talk to you again.
Yep, good to have you on the program. Japan is in the news. They have allegedly attached two destroyers to the Armada, which is allegedly, according to some reports, is just one carrier and two supply ships, plus two Japanese destroyers. I've heard reports, and you can correct me on that in a moment. And they've also got Japan, the government has warned citizens that they might have only 10 minutes to prepare for a North Korean missile. North Korea might be talking about building missiles that can reach the United States, but Kim Jong-un's regime already has lots of missiles that can reach Japan. They're practicing. They've said they fired missiles into the Japanese, the Sea of Japan, and they claimed it was practicing to hit military bases in Japan. Japanese government's advice isn't exactly helpful, amounting to basically you won't get the warning in time, but if you do, then go to a strong building. How serious should we take this? Should the Japanese people take these warnings? Is Japan caught up in this thing where it's going to be collateral damage, or can it stay off on the sidelines?
Well, I mean, it certainly could be a collateral damage, if you want to phrase it that way. It certainly could result in that. And as you say, North Korea has done some launches that have ended up in the Sea of Japan, so it is certainly possible that Korea could hit Japan. Of course, that would be suicide for North Korea, because that would obviously be the start of military confrontation that they're not going to win, ultimately. But they could certainly inflict a bit of damage in the meantime if they wanted to, and the obvious targets would be the U.S. military bases here in Japan, where a lot of U.S. military personnel are stationed. Although perhaps the more obvious target would be on the South Korean side of the border, but at any rate, perhaps what happens on the Korean Peninsula stays in the Korean Peninsula, so if you really want to launch something dramatic, perhaps it would be best to have a little bit of a breathing room in between the two. But as I say, such a move would be complete suicide. So I don't know how much of an impending threat it really is, but it is certainly on the table, and it is, as you would imagine, making the news here and is being discussed and talked about, the possibility. And as you say, the Japanese government is issuing warnings of various sorts to the people. I tweeted out an interesting tweet recently showing some a pamphlet from the Osaka city government about what to do if you're out and about on the street and a missile is heading towards Japan, or what to do if you're at home and a missile is heading towards Japan, or what to do if your child is at daycare and a missile is heading towards Japan. It's a very interesting document that's certainly a sign of the times, and as you say, it ultimately amounts to the 21st century equivalent of run, duck, and cover, and is probably as effective as that old canard really was in the first place. As of course we know, it Had absolutely no, I mean, running and ducking and covering would have no effect on a nuclear blast and the fallout therefrom. So at any rate, that's probably not going to be advice that's going to save very many lives. But it is, as it's certainly something that's being played up right now in the media. And one of the effects of that, as always, is to keep people dependent and reliant on the government to be the protectors, and oh, what will we do if, you know, the North Koreans come to invade? And it always plays into the hands of whoever happens to be in political power at the time. I think this round of hysteria is no exception.
And you actually see some hysteria in Japan? Is it in the media, or is it in the people?
I think it's in the media. I haven't seen it in the people. There are reports that there are people buying, you know, emergency supplies and, you know, bomb shelter type equipment and water filters and what have you. But the report that I was reading about that was talking about a specialized specialty company that specializes in those types of things that had sold a grand total of 50 water filters or something in the last couple of months, which may be good business for them, more than usual, but still, on the whole, on the scheme of things, for a country of 125 million plus people, it's not exactly people panicking and rushing out and buying, you know, emergency goods en masse. So I think it's largely a media phenomenon at this point. I haven't seen it a lot in the people, but as I say, it's leading the news programs and certainly being talked about in the media quite a bit.
Well, I would have to assume that if any country on Earth was sensitive to the idea of nuclear weapons, it would be Japan, having been the only country that's been exposed to them.
Well, of course, yes. And, of course, that's why Japan has always been quite, ironically, in the leading forefront of countries that are opposed to nuclear weapons, or at least pretend to be opposed to nuclear weapons while making side deals that go unnoticed for decades with the United States about their nuclear arsenal. But that aside, they've been at the forefront of protesting against nuclear weapons, and at the same time at the forefront of using nuclear energy, which seems paradoxical, but not if you find out that the promotion of nuclear energy in Japan was specifically one of the targets of the Eisenhower-era Atoms for Peace propaganda program that they were doing in the wake of World War II to try to rehabilitate the image of nuclear energy from a public that had only really, at that point, seen it used in the bomb. And Japan was one of the key targets of that campaign, and there were CIA operatives in the editorial media here in Japan at that time that were pushing the idea, and they had the sort of propaganda wagon go around Japan displaying the Atoms for Peace propaganda about how great it'll be, you know, energy too cheap to meter and all of that. And that ultimately did create at least the political cover for the nuclear program that was then developed here. So there's that interesting paradox, but you're certainly right. I mean, obviously, as a nation, it is particularly sensitive to the idea of nuclear weapons.
Do you think Kim Jong-un is going to do? Will he ever just shut up, or is he going to push this until it absolutely blows up in his face?
Well, I mean, why switch horses in midstream, or whatever that analogy is? Mm-hmm. At any rate, it has been working for North Korea for the last decade and a half, really, where we see these types of belligerent statements and provocative statements and tests and increasing development of nuclear weapons and things like this. And that has so far resulted in nothing really devastating to North Korea. Some sanctions here and there, but obviously they're not really effective at toppling the regime itself. So, again, I don't think it's really been a losing strategy for them to this point. And so why would they discontinue it unless they have reason to? So, again, I'm not sure. Let's put it this way. I don't believe that Kim Jong-un is suicidal, so I don't believe that he actually wants to push this through to military confrontation. But then again, reality has a way of coming in the way of people's beliefs, so what do I know? But at any rate, it would be suicidal to push this any further than the state that it's in right now.
Am I right that Kim Jong-un is only about 26 years old? Is that true?
That does not seem right to me. I think he is in his 30s, but I would have to look that up.
Well, I was just wondering. I mean, I may not be correct about that.
Oh, you know what? In fact, you're much closer than I am. He is 33. Okay.
Well, that's old enough to maybe have some sense. I was wondering if he was 26. It seemed like I'd heard that, and I was wondering, is anyone who's 26 years old old enough to really manage a country?
I would say not.
I would
anyone
say
who's
so
26
too.
Years old, old enough, mature enough to even run a household, probably,
I understand.
Probably not.
I understand. Well, he's 33. He might know. But even so, he's been kind of spoiled in his own way, the way I understand it. Got a grandfather. He's following a father and a grandfather that that owned and operated North Korea for all practical purposes, if I understand correctly. He's got to have a sense of privilege. And I wonder if it makes him more dangerous than someone who had to fight for the position. All right, let's move over to Bitcoin. Here's some headlines, interesting. Bitcoin, this is from Cointelegraph, and I have a series of headlines. Most of them are from that source. And one of them says, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies shaping future economy, capitalism morphing. Two questions. Is Bitcoin actually shaping the future economy? And second one, do we really have capitalism without any capital? I mean, debt instruments are not capital. They treat them as if they're capital, but they're not really capital. Does that make a difference? Do we really have capital when we're using debt instruments as currency?
Well, that's an interesting point, because I think the neglected factor in people's economic assessments, including the fundamental economic paradigm of what we live in, is it capitalism, is it socialism, is it some sort of mixed economy? I think that is more predicated on the monetary system itself than anyone really, or many commentators, give credit for.
Absolutely.
So I think you're right about that. And so, Bitcoin certainly, as I'm sure we've talked about before here on the program, it does have the potential to be that type of disruptive technology that essentially could potentially change the monetary system. Now, there's a lot of caveats in there with potentialies and coulds, but that's because, as always, the devil is in the details and how it is implemented. But it is extremely interesting to see right now, because Bitcoin is at a very precarious point in its development at the moment. It is at the same time as it is being, it has, just, for example, just been officially approved as a form of payment, a settlement currency in Japan, so it can be used for that purpose, and we're starting to see Japanese retailers finding ways to integrate it into their electronic payments technologies. And the SEC is at least contemplating giving a second shot to the Winklevoss twins, who people might know were trying to float a Bitcoin ETF, an exchange-traded fund based on Bitcoin. The SEC denied that earlier. They're now thinking about giving them a second chance at their application. So there's some interesting moves towards potential greater adoption of Bitcoin, but at the same time, there's an interesting technical... it's not a glitch. It's just that something that was built into the original protocol of Bitcoin that I won't get too much into the technical details of it, but basically the block size was arbitrarily capped at 1 megabyte back when the network was first created. With
tell
the
us what that means. What does the block size, it is maximum amount of data you can put in this block? What's in the block? How many blocks in a coin or whatever?
Yes, so the blockchain is the distributed ledger upon which Bitcoin is built, and this is so it's a ledger of transactions, so it contains all of the transactions that occur in the Bitcoin network. So if you give a Bitcoin to this person or you buy something from that person in Bitcoin, that transaction is lodged in the ledger. Like in any other monetary system, there has to be a way of keeping track of these types of payments, but with Bitcoin, with the blockchain specifically, it's a distributed ledger. So everyone who has a Bitcoin node, a wallet, has the entire ledger. So it's not a single point of failure or a single central server that controls it. Now, again, there's details about how this is done, but miners, quote unquote, mine Bitcoin by solving cryptographic puzzles. And when they solve a puzzle, they get some Bitcoin as a reward, and they get to add a block to the blockchain, this distributed ledger. They get to take the next batch of transactions and put them officially in the ledger, and then they're downloaded by the entire network. And those blocks, it's called a blockchain because it's a chain of blocks, and they're added in 1 megabyte blocks, one on top of the other, on top of the other. So the transactions are recorded in those blocks, and those blocks were limited to 1 megabyte. just arbitrarily at the beginning of the network, which really didn't make a difference because when the network first started, there were maybe a few kilobytes of transactions per block. Well, now we've reached basically the cap. Now it's at the point where it's often 100% capacity for these blocks, where all of the space is being used by transactions, which means waiting times for processing transactions are going up, and fees for processing transactions are going up. Where it used to cost fractions of a penny to send Bitcoin, now it's costing a dollar, a couple of dollars. We're looking at the possibility that it might cost a few dollars per transaction, which obviously has ramifications for the idea of, you know, using Bitcoin to buy a cup of coffee or something. If it takes, you know, 20 hours to process a transaction and a few dollars, that just doesn't make sense. So there's a lot of debate basically going on right now about how to solve this problem. What's the best way? Should we do this? Should we do that? And that technical dispute is becoming something of a, I don't know, civil war, but certainly it is starting to tear apart the Bitcoin community, and it's going to be extremely interesting. So it's in a very precarious space, but at the same time, it's now being a lot more and more widely adopted. So we see the price rising and rising. It's now heading towards $1,300, again, surpassing gold. So it's a very interesting time for Bitcoin.
It's they've been extremely volatile. They've been 30% off in the last month or so, if I understand correctly, and then they've recovered that. But there's a lot of volatility in it, and you have to wonder, and Bitcoin may be failing or put under a bunch of stress, which is what you're talking about, from just its success. When it was a small operation and it was kind of a dream and everybody looked at it and they said, oh, this is cool. Now it's become so popular that maybe You're beginning to see the warts on these coins, all right, in ways where we're no longer dealing with the ideal, we are now dealing with the practical. And I've seen a report that there are, and I don't recall the number correctly, but several hundred alternative cryptocurrencies. And if Bitcoin is having any, and it's the majority, it's, what, if I had to guess, if I said Bitcoin was 70% of the cryptocurrency community, would I be roughly correct or would I be way off?
I don't really know the percentage, but my feeling is that that would actually be much too small. I think it would be upwards probably of 90%.
Okay. They're carrying all the weight. They're the big target. And yet we've got hundreds of other cryptocurrencies coming onto the market. And how long before we have one that actually makes Bitcoin look silly?
That's a very good question, and it really depends who you ask. I think there were a lot of Bitcoin believers who think, well, there's been competition since the time that Bitcoin was born, and none of it has ever come anywhere close to surpassing Bitcoin or even catching up to Bitcoin, so nothing will change. But as you point out, I mean, there are some significant competition that's happening because of this change in, failing of Bitcoin, or at any rate, failing of it as a transactional currency. But that's, I think, the way to see this civil war that's taking place right now. The two main camps in how to deal with this problem really break out into people who think that Bitcoin should be used as a transactional currency, like a PayPal or currency kind of thing, and those who think it should be a store of value. And that's
we'll have to break out. We'll have to break there. We'll get back to that in a minute and see whether it's going to be a store of value or not. And when we return from a couple of commercials, I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival, and our guest is James Corbett from CorbettReport.com. Please stay tuned.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addis, and this is Financial Survival, and I'm here with my guest, James Corbett, from thecorbettreport.com. James is calling in from Japan. We're talking about Bitcoin. One of the things that I'm curious about, has Bitcoin's success been a function of marketing or technology? And I know that the answer is both, but which one is primary? Is Bitcoin better than all the rest of them? Is that why it is? It comprises a majority of the coins used in the world right now, or does it have something to do with marketing and just they caught the wave? They were the first ones, and they caught the wave, and
Essentially, yes. I mean, essentially, since Bitcoin was the first cryptocurrency as we understand them today, it obviously had that built-in head start against any other competitors. And every other competitor is really contrasted to Bitcoin. Oh, this is different because this cryptocurrency can do this, or because this crypto. So I think Bitcoin is still the benchmark and the standard, and probably, I mean, for the foreseeable future, will be. But let's not get too comfortable with that, because I'm sure 10 years ago people would have thought MySpace and Dig and other websites that have gone in the dustbin of history would have been the biggest things on the web and they'll never be replaced, and now it's people scratching their heads saying, what's that? So, you know, we should never be too comfortable with such pronouncements. And as we were talking about before the break there, we were talking about Bitcoin's market share, and I was positing that it was probably in the 90% range. I just looked it up. Although the cryptocurrency market cap has continued growing, it's now over $30 billion. Bitcoin now comprises about $20 billion of that, so about two-thirds. We're looking about 67%. Although it was 96% of the overall market cap of cryptocurrency back in 2013, it's now dipped down to two-thirds of the market share, which I think is an indication. The overall market cap is still growing. Bitcoin is still growing, but other competitors are taking up a growing share of the uptake, and I think that's because of technological innovations, or at least promises that these alternatives are putting out there.
I think I don't own any Bitcoin, and I'm not knowledgeable about it. I'm interested. I'm kind of fascinated, and I can see that there's a revolution taking place here, but I have little knowledge of it beyond that. But the way I understand this, part of the fascination with Bitcoin in the last few years has been the report that the use of the Bitcoin could be anonymous. And yet if we've got the blockchain technology that records everything, I don't think we can really maintain anonymity with Bitcoin. Is that true or false?
Yes, that is true. And I think that was a misleading part of the hype around Bitcoin, or at least a misunderstanding that was often carried on in the hype around Bitcoin in the first several years. It was never an anonymous currency. It's a pseudonymous currency. So every transaction is recorded and publicly available, but they are transactions between wallet addresses that are just strings of numbers and letters and not personally identifiable except unless dot dot dot. And of course there are ways that people can find to track various wallet addresses to various people. I mean, that is possible, and it's a question of how well you use your wallet, and you know, whether you follow good standard practices about changing addresses every time you do a transaction and things like this. You can make it more pseudonymous, we'll put it that way. But it was never anonymous, and it was never meant to be. There are other digital currencies that have some of the competitors claim to be at least more potentially anonymous than Bitcoin, and that's their selling point.
I've got three headlines here that dealt with the question of anonymity, and one is teenager uses Bitcoin to buy anonymity for bomb threats, faces U.S. extradition. Second headline is why the European Union is against anonymous digital currencies. And the third one is Bitcoin value is high only due to lawbreakers. And that's from Forbes, an analyst at Forbes magazine. It just looks to me like they have succeeded to the point where they've become a target. And I'm wondering if people are going to pick them apart and whether... who is there to defend Bitcoin? I get the feeling that this thing is so decentralized. Who feels obligated to defend Bitcoin? Who is defending Bitcoin? Is there any centralized defense mechanism that we're fighting for Bitcoin?
There is no central authority that can speak for Bitcoin, and I think that's part of the point of Bitcoin. But there are obviously groups that have formed that want to, if not speak for Bitcoin as a whole, at least steer it in one direction or another. So we see groups, again, battle lines forming around this idea of the kind of civil war that we see taking shape right now between people who want it to remain a decentralized and basically store of value, and then others who want it as more of a payment currency that they can use as kind of electronic money. And so we have different groups with their own interests that are battling it out for that. And again, since it is decentralized, there's no one group that has a definitive way of doing that. It is really up to the users of Bitcoin, all of the various users, not just people who have a wallet with some Bitcoin in it, but the miners and other people who have those kinds of interests and stake in the network, that get to ultimately vote on it, in a sense, because whichever protocol you decide to use that you signal that you are willing to use is the one that will eventually be used, and so you can change the protocol, and if enough people adopt that new protocol, then you have a new protocol for Bitcoin. So it's an interesting, I mean, in some ways, it's kind of an experiment in decentralized governance, I guess you could say, in some sense.
I agree with you, and I can't imagine that the New World Order is particularly pleased unless they can figure out a way to capture the technology.
I think a lot of people get bedazzled by the jargon and the technology of it, but I think it's essentially, I mean, when you see pronouncements about the European Union and others, you know, fretting and twisting their hands about this anonymous currency, it's the same thing as the war on cash. I mean, they hate the idea of an anonymous currency for the exact, whether it's technological or just pieces of paper, because, hey, they can't control and monitor and squeeze out every, you know, drop of flesh, pound of flesh from their tax cattle. So that's, I think, ultimately it comes down to the same issues. And again, it's just the question of, you know, where is this heading and which way will it be implemented? And interestingly enough, I just saw a report on the United Nations are scrambling to really trying their best to bring about a Bitcoin-based or cryptocurrency-based payments systems that they can use to distribute funds to various countries, because they're actually, in the article that was talking about, it was talking about the UN, you know, worrying about how fiat currencies can collapse, and in, you know, apocalypse scenarios, you know, you need to transfer funds immediately. This is the easiest way to do it. And so it's interesting, even the UN is kind of picking up on this, but one can imagine once the United Nations starts getting their hands on it, it starts to get used for political purposes and corrupted rather than the, you know, whatever ideals may have been enshrined in the original, you know, protocol documents.
You see a lot of irony in the idea that the world government is trying to wage a war on cash at the same time, Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are waging a war on world government, from my perspective. And who's going to win this? I mean, these people are competing now. If Bitcoin is allowed to continue as a privatized medium, what will happen to the petrodollar? What will happen to fiat currency in general, whether it's digital or paper? I mean, is this a really major threat to the world's monetary system?
It really could be. Again, the dreaded could and possibly, but it really, the idea of the technology, at any rate, to, you know, not taking into account its implementation, but the idea really does supplant the central bank fiat currency system that is in place right now. And it is possible to imagine an international currency that people can use for digital transactions or otherwise, even face-to-face transactions, that cannot really be controlled, monitored, or outside influenced by a third party, which of course is the fundamental nature of the monetary system that we've lived under our entire lives, and that people couldn't really even imagine a different way of doing it a decade or two ago. So it is a revolution in understanding, but as you know, again, it's always the devil's in the details in the implementation. And I think you're right. Can it be allowed to continue as this privatized, or at least not non-governmental thing, or will governments simply start using the technology for their own ends in their own centrally controlled private blockchains, which of course kind of, you know, takes away the central idea of the currency itself? And that's why we see central bank after central bank experimenting with and running tests on their own blockchains and cryptocurrencies.
Got another headline here. Korean Bitcoin exchange Yapazon confirms $5 million hack, all customers to pay with balances. And this is this Bitcoin exchange, what's going to happen? The hackers got $5 million, apparently, or the equivalent of $5 million, and they are dividing the loss among all of the remaining subscribers to this exchange who did not lose all their wealth, and they're all working together. At least that's the idea, if I understand correctly. And if you're familiar with this, tell me what's really happening here, and is this evidence of people on Bitcoin being extraordinarily sociable, where they will share in the losses if they're hacked, or is this reason to say, oh my gosh, I don't know if I want to get into this? I'm going to, if somebody else gets hacked, do I have to pay for it?
Again, I think this is the type of story that points to the fact that people will look at the technological side of it rather than the fundamental what's going on side of it, which is, it's essentially the same thing as gold or silver or precious metals. If you don't physically possess it yourself, then you don't possess it. And it's the same thing if you are storing it in some kind of vault or whatever, and that vault gets broken into, you know, well, too bad for you. Kind of thing. And maybe if you're with a good company that will reimburse you for the gold that was stolen, then, you know, all for the better. But it's just another sign of why people shouldn't be leaving their cryptocurrency on exchanges and just trusting that, oh, it's safe because it's in that exchange. Now, if you don't physically have it in your wallet that you're securing yourself on your own computer, then, you know, it's the same thing as having gold theoretically in some kind of exchange or, you know, in an ETF or something like that. It's only as good as the paper that it's written on, which usually isn't very much.
You think Bitcoin is ever going to be a stable media for preserving value, for preserving wealth? I can understand that it works very well for buy and sell, but what about preservation? And it's a little what we're talking about. Maybe you have to have it in your own wallet rather than someone else's exchange. But can it ever be a reliable means to preserve wealth?
Well, I think it has been so far. It has been doing what it is meant to do, which is really be a deflationary currency as opposed to the inflationary currencies, the fiat currencies that the banksters print out of thin air whenever they need to start a new war or whatever else they need to fund. They just print more up. Bitcoin works the other way. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin issued. That's built into the protocol. And I think we're over half of that, I think, has been issued so far. And there's a schedule over the next 10 years or whatever it is that the rest will be issued in decreasing amounts. So that's how that's baked into the cake. So it was always meant to be that kind of store of value, there will only ever be that much issued, so it will actually increase in value as time goes on, because, you know, as the market expands, but there's comparatively less and less of the Bitcoin available because it's not being issued willy-nilly. And so it has been doing that, and that's why it started out at, you know, pennies or fractions of a penny when it first started, and now it's at $1,300. So that is what Bitcoin has been. But now the question is, well, if you have a great store of value that, you know, holds and even increases its value over time, then is that useful as a payment currency? Because, well, if you pay for something in Bitcoin today, well, if your Bitcoin's worth 10 times that much, you know, next year, then you've just lost 10 times the value, right? Or that's the way people will think of it. So you don't want to spend a deflationary currency. So that's the kind of battle that's going on right now between people who want this more as a usable, spendable payment currency and others who want it to maintain the store of value that it has been so far.
We have about a minute and a half left. The guy who devised Bitcoin and the blockchain, I don't know if he's responsible for both, but I believe his name is Satoshi something.
Nakamoto, I think.
Nakamoto, yeah. Sounds right.
Well,
is he a real individual, or is that just a name? Or does anyone know?
It is a pseudonym. It's not a real person's name, but, you know, is it a person? Is it a number of people? Is it a government agency? I mean, no one knows. And there's been a few people over the years who have got the scoop, and this is the guy, honest. And then the story has always fallen apart, even under the slightest inspection. So no one knows to this day exactly who that was.
It's quite extraordinary, because the guy has come up with something as astonishing as the assembly line. Henry Ford and the assembly line, oh my gosh, I mean, it was a technological revolution. This guy's, whoever this was, whoever they were, this, you know, they're not obviously taking credit for this.
Nope, but they
Isn't
do have another
profession. Is that unusual? Has that ever happened before?
Probably in various ways, but not in officially sanctioned ways. I mean, we could look at who really wrote Shakespeare. I, for one, don't think it was William Shakespeare, and there are others who believe that. But who,
we're going to have to save that. We're going to have to save that mystery for another day, because we're out of time, James. I want to thank you for being on the program. As always, I always enjoy talking to you. James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. I'll be back tomorrow with Melody. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Todd the producer, and James Corbett. Bye.
Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.